Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to be talking first and foremost about problems internal to the United States that may make it very difficult for us, well, not only to protect, but actually to survive the country we love, namely the problems that we're confronting with the lack of election integrity and the seeming inability of majorities of electors to have their way, in certain cases at least. A man who is following these issues, as he does most things, with great acuity and thoughtfulness and courage, is our friend Benjamin Weingarten. He is a very impressive intellect, a public policy specialist of the first order. You can find his work at the Federalist and also at the Claremont Institute. He is the author of American Ingrate, a marvelous book about the radical left joining forces with the Islamists in the person of Ilhan Omar, member of Congress from Minnesota. Ben, it's always good to have you with us, but especially at a time such as this. Thank you for joining us.
Frank, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Let's start with sort of your overview of election integrity at the moment. So we've had two elections just in the past month that have particularly, I think, been vexing, to say the least. Well, the midterms more generally were, but specifically what went down in Arizona. And then most recently, this special runoff election in Georgia. Your thoughts?
I think we've had the now two cycles, as you noted, normalization of the abnormal. And I think that that abnormal is the notion that we no longer have a singular election day where people vote in person with identification, and may the best man or woman win. Now, well, we have...
If I could just add, on paper ballots, tabulated on the spot, in a bipartisan, overseen process, as you say, with the results available by the end of the day, as a general.
That's right. And instead, now, we've gone to a system of weeks of voting, where in the least secure fashion, remotely, where you don't know who is overseeing the individual actually filling out the ballot, to the extent the individual filling out the ballot is actually the person whose name is on it. Then you have, of course, ballot curing, and then we have the results coming in over the course of days rather than on the night of. And that process—
Thanks in part to machines that are supposed to facilitate that tabulation. I mean, it's the craziest thing you can imagine, really, isn't it?
And the one point that I think is critical to note on this is that Democrats had built the infrastructure to exploit a system like this. Democrats have been pushing for years for a system like this, which takes all of the integrity measures effectively off the table and instead permits, as we saw in 2020, the Zuckerbucks operation, I think, illustrates this, that there's a whole massive infrastructure to drive out votes and to exploit the mechanisms that we have in the way of election offices, in driving remote voting, in driving early voting and the like, in ballot harvesting measures. The left has all of the infrastructure to dominate in a game where these are the rules. They've pushed to change the rules of the game, consequently, and now they've been in a position to reap the benefits. And we've seen these oddities in outcomes now, two election cycles in a row. And I believe the reason that hell needs to be raised about this is because this is normalized now. After two of these, we are effectively at normalization of a process that completely undermines the confidence of tens of millions of Americans in the integrity of the vote. For the quote-unquote our democracy defenders, this is an assault on democracy because of, at very, very, very minimum, the appearance of corruption and illegality and the obvious increase in the potential for fraud baked into the system, as none other than Jimmy Carter himself used to acknowledge.
Yes, indeed. Specifically warning, along with Jim Baker, on a bipartisan basis against these mail-in ballots as something that's just fraught with problems of fraud inherent in them. And Ben, let me just ask you, one of the things that has, you know, seemed to be also emerging in this now normalized abnormality is that Republicans have generally not responded by adapting to this kind of process. They, as a friend of ours put it, they remain focused on gathering votes while Democrats are focused on gathering ballots. And it turns out theirs is a much more effective way to engineer outcomes, shall we say. When you look at that kind of failure to adapt, one possibility is that you go back to a process that is designed to be free and fair and accountable and give you rapid results in a very carefully monitored way. Or should we, in fact, be trying to simply accommodate this new normal, as you put it, and try to compete effectively in that regard?
Yeah, I think there's an emerging battle among those on the right on kind of what is to be done when you have a process effectively serving as punishment here for not winning these battles previously or having courage of our convictions, I guess, in the case of our purported representatives. I think as a practical matter, there is no alternative but to compete in a system that is inherently flawed and rife with, again, a very, very, very minimum, the potentiality for corruption. That said, the fact that we are conceding that you have to play on those grounds as a matter of practical reality, I think, is a concession of a loss. And it's not clear to me necessarily that we will be able to regain what was lost in the sense of actually going back to the system that prevailed in this country for two centuries.
And even if you're able to effectively compete and therefore win, it may be impossible to undo the damage.
One has to win under a system that the other side is decades and tens of billions of dollars ahead on, while they are engineering even further reforms, I am sure, to make the system even reforms, so-called, to undermine the integrity of the system even further and to put their political foes at an even further opposition. A further deficit. And so you have to win, and then you have to change the rules. And in so doing, of course, you have to be able to then win under a system where you're way behind. And you also need to convince voters. And I'm not sure that many Republicans, A, have the courage of their convictions on this issue, B, can actually clearly and cogently articulate why it is that the system that has now been instituted for two cycles is so disastrous for anything resembling a Republican form of government. It's obviously incumbent upon them to do so. We have to win now under a system that is inherently flawed, however. And so I do think it is unclear if ultimately we can restore what's been lost. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try as best we can, but I do think this is a very cautionary tale. And we've seen this kind of degradation in the integrity of virtually every institution, quite frankly, in this country.
By design, I would argue. That's kind of the Marxist takedown, of which this election business is just one manifestation. Ben, we have to take a short break here in just a second, but I did want to just introduce a topic that I think becomes all the more important in light of what you've just said, and that is a case before the Supreme Court. In fact, they heard testimony from parties to a lawsuit about whether state legislators are, in fact, responsible for setting elections, their timing, and their conduct, as the Constitution clearly states is the case. We'll talk about that and much more with Ben Weingarten right after this. Stay tuned.
Thank you. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Global elites have long sought to establish control over the rest of us. Today, Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum is pursuing a great reset explicitly designed to do just that. There is, however, another such effort underway at the moment, one in which the Biden administration is officially engaged behind closed doors. The venue is backroom negotiations conducted by the World Health Organization. That's the supranational entity that endorsed Xi Jinping's totalitarian China model, which responded to the Wuhan virus with mandatory lockdowns, vaccinations, and digital passports that have helped kill over a million Americans. The closest thing to oversight of the WHO's incipient digital gulag was an informal hearing convened yesterday by Senator Ron Johnson to examine the pandemic and those who exploited it. Secret efforts to institutionalize and perpetuate the recent horrors must be halted and rigorously investigated. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are speaking with one of the brightest young minds, relatively, in the conservative movement, certainly one of the most influential. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is an essayist of great renown, the author of American Ingrate, a wonderful book about Ilhan Omar, among others, and one of the people at the Federalist and the Claremont Institute who I believe has really helped shape our thinking on so many issues. And we're deeply grateful to him both for doing that and for his time to talk about them today. Ben, I just mentioned that there was a hearing by the Supreme Court about a case in which what is being described as a radical and extreme legal theory, namely that state legislatures are exclusively responsible for setting the timing and the nature and the conduct of elections. The last time I looked at the Constitution, that's what it says. How is it that this is so extreme, and what are the stakes in terms of how the Supreme Court might rule on this issue?
Well, to your point, there's a major tell here that there's been rampant hysteria across the left raising this idea of the so-called independent state legislature theory as, I guess, allowing some kind of MAGA radical takeover. And that, of course, has been put forth by the likes of Democrat super lawyer, election integrity buster par excellence, Mark Elias, as well as, by the way, Hillary Clinton, who said essentially that Republicans were already engaged in election fraud and corruption over 2024 with respect to this so-called independent state legislature theory. To your point, last I checked, the legislature makes laws, and state governments are the ones responsible for dictating what those laws are when it comes to our elections, primarily. What's at issue here is, as I understand it, the Supreme Court in North Carolina said, tossed out a map, basically, that had been put forth by the legislature with respect to redistricting, and replaced it with their own. Now, again, last I checked, that's not the purview of judges. Judges to adjudicate on legality, period, full stop, not to rewrite a map, essentially. And so, you know, this notion that, oh my gosh, state legislatures are actually going to control when it comes to the election system, I think tells you everything you need to know about where the left is on the merits. I think it's clear that they want then courts, and by the way, executives within states to be able to rewrite law as they see fit. And this goes back to a major failing of the Supreme Court.
The beginning of the election process itself, as we've seen in places like Pennsylvania in the last cycle.
Well, and exactly to that point, this was the problem. And I wrote about this at the Epoch Times around the time of the ruling in 2020, when the Supreme Court refused to take on litigation over Pennsylvania willy-nilly executives rewriting rules and regs on the eve of an election. when that happened and the Supreme Court did not step in, that created this opportunity for the left to say, look, who needs legislatures, essentially? And we can fight in all sorts of other ways, including through judges and governors, in order to make rule and law. That's a potentially a dagger at the heart of our system itself.
And conversely, if the Supreme Court does uphold the clear meaning of the Constitution in this regard, it may be one of the things that could help undo some of the damage of which we spoke in the previous block. We'll see. We'll be keeping our fingers crossed and the Supreme Court in our prayers. Let me ask you, Ben Weingarten, about another matter quickly, if I can. Twitter, under the new management of Elon Musk, has released some very illuminating internal correspondence in which it's now clear Twitter executives were in regular contact with and, in fact, being directed on how to deal with essentially censoring people using their platform at the direction of the U.S. government under, the previous administration, ironically, the FBI especially, and certainly the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party in the run-up to the 2020 election. What did you make of these revelations, and more to the point, what do we do now?
Well, there's so many different aspects to this story, but I think the most important one, I would argue, and I've joked tongue-in-cheek, but somewhat seriously also, that we may find more out in terms of the substance of the politicization and weaponization of the national security apparatus and its auxiliaries in the putatively private sector from the releases of Twitter files than we will from John Durham's special counsel. And the reason I make that case is we've long known that the national security apparatus has sought to suppress certain narratives and put forth other ones. They've had a media that's been complicit in essentially engaging in their information operations. As I've argued, the Hunter Biden laptop story being the ultimate information operation. And then, of course, big tech is a huge partner in this relationship, in that big tech controls the propagation of the narratives, but the deep state works hand in hand with its mouthpieces in the media to craft those narratives. And sometimes there's circularity within those processes, as we saw with the Carter Page FISA, for example. So what we have in the Twitter files, at least with respect to Hunter Biden, is we know clearly that Team Biden itself was passing along censorship notices, essentially, and that when they said jump, Twitter asked how high in certain instances. With respect to Hunter Biden itself, it was clear that they were on shoddy ground internally, the deliberations, showing people saying, how do we justify suppressing this story? And they relied on the notion of a hack and leak. And we know that intelligence services were having weekly meetings with Twitter saying that there could be some kind of hack and leak around Hunter Biden as well. We don't even need a smoking gun necessarily, because I think organically there would have been suppression of this story. But it's very clear we're as close as can be to a smoking gun in terms of the intelligence services. And then, of course, the 50 plus intelligence officers going to the media saying this has all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation, that there was this coordination. And I think the bottom line is, at the end of the day, we have to look at the national security and law enforcement apparatus, the media, and big tech as having been all one block. And that defines fascism, I will say, number one. And number two, hence the backlash against Elon Musk, because Elon Musk, for whatever flaws he may have, and there may be many, and you and I'm sure others agree that his China ties are certainly disconcerting, but Elon Musk took one massive piece of the public square, digital public square pie, out of the hands, or at least partially out of the hands, effectively, of our ruling class. And consequently, he's paid the biggest price to whistleblow of maybe any private citizen in the country on a dollar-by-dollar basis. But in so doing, I think that's why there's been such a huge backlash, and you've seen various aspects of the bureaucracy look to investigate his various business concerns, precisely because he threatens to expose just how corrupt this relationship is between the deep state, big tech, and the media. And by the way, I think Hunter Biden is just the tip of the iceberg. We know there's going to be files that come out likely around Chinese coronavirus suppression, censorship, and the like. But all of this comes down to a ruling class seeking a monopoly on narrative for a monopoly on power. And that's why the Twitter files are so substantial, in my view, because they threaten to upset that entire apple cart.
Well, not least, we've seen evidence of violations of the First Amendment to the Constitution and perhaps other laws as well. I want to commend to our audience a two-part series documentary that Tucker Carlson has just released. And when you see Joe Biden, it just calls to mind his direct lies about all of this. It really is, I think, the sort of thing that causes properly revulsion on the part of the American people. And I hope that there will be accountability for it all as well. Ben, I wanted to talk with you about one other topic, speaking of revulsion, and that is the failure of the Biden administration to stand firmly and visibly with the people of China, just as it's been doing about the people of Iran and arguably the people of Brazil as well, at a moment when they could very strongly use our support. But that will be for another day. And I want to thank you for your good piece about all of this at Epoch Times and commend it to our listeners. Thanks for joining us, my friend. I hope you'll come back to us very soon. In the meantime, this is very helpful clarity that you bring, as always, to these topics. We'll look forward to our next conversation. We'll be right back with more right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say I have with us a man I met just yesterday and have already formed a very high opinion of. His name is Pastor Akilah Yusuf. He is the pastor of the House on the Rock Church in Jos, northern Nigeria, and the regional director for an organization called the River of Life, a group of some 200 churches across the seven northern states of Nigeria, which are very much in the crosshairs now, literally, of enemies who are sacking the churches, killing, raping, and otherwise destroying their congregations. And the pastor has experienced some of this horror firsthand and is working with many others who have done so as well. We wanted to have him join us to talk a bit about what's going on in Nigeria, and what it portends if it's not stopped, this terrible persecution, predominantly of people of the Christian faith. Pastor, thank you for joining us here at Securing America. It was great to meet you yesterday, and delighted to have a chance to talk with you again today.
Thank you, Frank, for the opportunity. I count it a great honor to be on this platform and to share my ideas with everyone who is within the reach of this network, and it's a great pleasure to be here.
Wonderful, thank you. So just give us a little bit of a level setting on what is happening in northern Nigeria, but now increasingly in also what's called the Middle Belt, and what's in prospect for the southern part of Nigeria as well, the demographics of the country and who's doing what to whom?
Well, thank you, Frank, for the question. Anytime you want to get the details of a story, you're going to deal with the history behind the story. One of the things that's not reported mostly by the media is because they take the story in its face value without considering the other factors leading to what you now have on the table. You have to realize that the challenge we have in the northern Nigeria dates back to the days of Otuman Danfodio, the leader and the one of the leaders that brought the religion of Islam. When Islam got into Nigeria from the northern part of the country, it made advances until it got to the middle belt of Nigeria. Now, if you know the demographics and the geography of Nigeria, you know that the significant mountain regions you meet when you're coming from the desert part of the southern part of the Sahara Desert, it comes within the northern belt, the middle belt area. So our people about that time had a significant advantage with the jihadists who were on horses, but because they had the mountains to their advantage, it provided them a natural barrier and made them not to be a conquered territory. That informs why the Fulani tribe has consistently held it against our people because they were unable to make advancement for the advancement of religion of Islam to the south, to the whole part of Nigeria. That's one level.
And because tribe considers it their responsibility, their mission from God to spread that faith.
No? Yes, to spread it down to the south. That in fact, one of them said they were going to drive the sword of Islam to the Atlantic from the north to the Atlantic, which is in the southern part of the country. So this has formed one of the major reasons why there has been discontent between the House of Fulani and the people of the Middle Belt, because they were conquered. In fact, the Usman Danfodio was killed somewhere in Benue State. Now, we've had that as a lingering issue. So we have had different narratives, but the bid and the whole essence, the big picture, is how they can claim the land and still make us their slaves over. This has been going on for generations. So it's not a matter of today. Now, we have different hegemonies like the Boko Haram, the Fulani herdsmen, the bandits. They are all expressions, but the target is one and same, which is to have total control of the part that they consider as their own and that we are only but subservient to them. So there are different expressions, but the main target essentially is that to advance more than ever before the cause of their religion.
Okay, and the Boko Haram terrorist group,
yes,
designated by our government and others, the Fulani tribesmen, the bandits, as you say, they all have this sort of religious dimension and
yes,
ideology to their conquests.
Yes. So the
jihad is the vehicle for achieving
yes,
the conquests.
Yes.
And their targets are Christians.
Christians.
Who are described in official reporting and a lot of media, for that matter, as farmers.
Yes.
And they're somehow being in
because
conflict
you
with
have to
herdsmen.
Sell.
But is that really the nature of this?
That's the nature.
Fight?
Because you see, when you have an agenda, you use any narrative that will sell, that will become, you get empathy for. And so it essentially is to digress the general public from understanding what's the root cause of the issue. And that's why you keep having, we had a different name in the 1980s. It was called the Matatsine. Then by the time you get into the 90s, the name changed. By the time you get to the 2000s, the name changed. Now in this of recent, now we are having the Fulani herdsmen, you're hearing about the Boko Haram. So every decade, we seem to have the same monster, but with a different expression. The target is one
branded
and the same.
Something else.
Yes.
Yeah, the target is the same.
The target is the same.
And give us a sense of the toll that is being taken on
at the moment.
The
we
Christian
have,
populations in Nigeria.
I have visited several internal displaced camps all over the country, particularly in the area where I oversee. And you have thousands, countless. And because some of the ITP camps are set up without for any formality, so you don't even have the full record of how many are involved, but I can say you have nearly almost 10,000 have been displaced.
Okay, 10,000 have been displaced, but how many have been murdered?
Murdered. The number is in the thousands. I the last time I checked, you had almost like 20,000 that you can formally document that have been killed in the course in the last 10 years.
And people will simply roll up to villages in jeeps and other vehicles, and then use AK-47s and machetes and the like to kill the people who reside there and take their property and drive
because
the others away. Is that right?
Yeah, Frank. When you consider the kind of ammunition they use, their infrastructure, their the kind of equipment they use, is very clear that they cannot afford this equipment. It's clear that somebody is sponsoring them. These are sophisticated weapons that you don't find them in our geography. It has got to be imported. And nobody imports those kind of equipment without formal clearance from the top of the government. So to have those kind of machinery, you have ammo tanks, you have anti-aircraft missiles. Because last year, Frank, I need to say this, an Air Force jet that travels at Mach 2 was shot down in the forest, and the government was quiet about it. And so you don't have anti-aircraft missiles. That doesn't come through your suitcase in an airport. So government is very much in the picture.
So I want to ask you about this. The government of Nigeria at the moment is dominated by members of this Fulani tribe.
Correct.
Are they turning a blind eye to what's being done by their tribesmen?
Yes, it's very obvious.
Are they actually helping them?
Very obvious. It's obvious because I can say to you, Frank, we've not had a single prosecution of the perpetrators of this evil, not one single case. I mean, if you had a few cases there, but there has been no single case. In fact, you have issues where people have been arrested and then they are released without going through the due process of rule of law. And so it grants room for them to perpetrate this evil over and over again.
And
there has
continue.
Been no single prosecution, so nobody's been held accountable.
This brings me to the big issue of the moment. You are in the run-up now to a national election.
Yes.
To replace the aging and outgoing President Buhari,
yes,
who has a Fulani background and has been,
yes,
sympathetic to these jihadis. There is, as I understand it, a candidate on the ticket who is in ill health, but he's running for the presidency.
Yes.
And is accompanied in the second slot, the vice president slot, by another Muslim, which,
yes,
is unusual. It contravenes, I think, the general practice, as I understand it. But there's something in this individual's background that's particularly alarming. Tell us a little bit about him, if you would.
Well, he has an outstanding case of a drug case from the state of, when he used to live in Chicago some years ago. That is in the public knowledge. I mean, the Americans can confirm that. He had to forfeit some of his money to avoid going to jail.
But I'm asking about his experience in Nigeria. What was his,
yes,
background?
Now, his background, basically, number one, like you said, he is having a health issue. On Monday this week, he was at the Chatham House in London, and he could not as much as coordinate his thoughts while he was brought under an interview with, you have several journalists who are in the room trying to get him to.
I'm sorry, I'm not being clear. His health is such that he may not last very long.
No.
His running mate has a problematic background.
Yes.
Tell
his
us
running
about
mate
that.
Is known to be the champion, and it was within his era when he was a governor of Borno State that we had the emergence of the Boko Haram. It was under his government, and it is traceable and is verifiable about his involvement with the Boko Haram. It happened right when he was governor of Borno State. And now he's been put down there as the intended vice presidential candidate. And the way that the narrative is looking, the man on the ticket, who is of the ruling party, cannot and will not be able to survive the stress of the job. And so the hope is that if he's out of the way, this vice president, who by law now becomes the next president of Nigeria, and which allows the perpetration of this evil that has been ongoing for nearly two decades.
This is obviously completely unacceptable.
Yes, it is. Unacceptable.
Must stand against this.
Yes.
We had some very important meetings of this subject in Washington yesterday, and we'll look forward to further visits with you about all this. Pastor Akilah Yusuf, thank you very much for coming to that again.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Pastor Akilah Yusuf, for joining us today.
Thank you for this audience. I really appreciate this.
We'll talk with you again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the War of Ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is a friend and colleague of many years. He has been involved in national security policy and practice for five decades or so, including time we spent together in the Reagan Pentagon, in his case as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who was responsible really for cutting off the Soviet Union's access to technology that would be relevant to their military capabilities. His name is Dr. Stephen Bryan. He went on from that role in the U.S. government to a number of other posts, including as the president of Finmeccanica, a major defense contractor. He is these days, I'm very pleased to say, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and a man who compiled a very important new book on Taiwan and how we must act to protect it against threats from the Chinese Communist Party. Steve Bryan, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be with you.
We have a lot to talk about and not a lot of time, I'm afraid. Let's start with your thoughts on what is taking place in the war between Ukraine and Russia and the knock-on effects of that war. Obviously, most immediately for the people of Ukraine, for their infrastructure, and for the country itself, perhaps, and our interests there, if any, and what you think we should be doing at the moment about what's happening.
Well, to quote Vladimir Putin yesterday, he said this war is going to take a long time. It's going to go on for a number of years, which actually is the same thing the Pentagon's saying. It's going to take a long time and go on for a number of years. That means, you know, mounting casualties on both sides, and they're pretty high, and they'll get higher. The collapse of the Ukrainian infrastructure because the Russians are attacking it regularly now, and if they keep it up, there's not going to be a whole lot left of Ukraine at the end of the day, which is one of the reasons why it would be better to settle this thing somehow, if it's possible. Because I don't know.
Yeah, settling it is, I guess, the issue. Settling it somehow is well said. I was at an event that the Institute for Study of War did in New York this week, in which there was a fairly substantial amount of praise for the Ukrainians and their fight and their pluckiness and the need for us to support them in all of that. My guess is that whether we do or whether we don't continue in that regard, that if the Ukrainians are not going to give up, in the face of this very hard winter that is now in the offing, thanks in part to the attacks on their electric grid.
I think we're going to see
the Europeans starting to bail on them for the same reason, hard winter coming and lack of energy and so on. How do you see this translating, Steve Brian, into the prospects for a settlement that would be other than basically acquiescence to the Russians, securing what they set out to, at least part of what they set out to in Ukraine?
You know, there was a possibility under the Minsk agreements to have a settlement even before the war. Minsk agreements was an agreement between these two breakaway republics, Luhansk and Donetsk, Ukrainian government, Moscow, and was secured by the Germans and the French, basically, and supervised by the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe. That was the deal, was signed deal.
By Putin.
Everyone agreed.
By Putin.
Yes. Well, by Putin's people. He didn't personally sign it. But anyway, the main point is that it was an agreed arrangement. What it would have done at the end of the day was to allow these provinces, if we can call them that, to have autonomy but still be under the Ukrainian constitution and basically under Ukrainian law. So it was a compromise, but it was not such a bad one. Now we know from two sources. One was Peter Poroshenko, who was the Ukrainian president then, and now from Merkel, who was the chancellor of Germany, that this was not a serious deal. It was only a deal to buy time so Ukraine could build up its forces to be able to take back these areas. So that's really bad news for two reasons. One is that they hoodwinked the Russians. And you don't want to do that if you, because then you lose your credibility in the future. And secondly, it threw away not such a bad deal that would have avoided this war and all the deaths and destruction that we've seen.
I guess, Steve, that given what the Russians did with Crimea, whether in fact the Russians were doing anything other than buying time themselves. And clearly, I think people who know Putin have indicated that they think he's still, determined to get Kiev itself, Kyiv, as they call it now, and perhaps, who knows, the Baltic states and other parts of what he considers to be properly, part of the Russian Empire. Do you discredit that?
Well, he seems to focus on where the Russian populations are. He did that in Georgia. He did it in Crimea, which was pretty much 90% Russians. Eastern Ukraine, same story. And if you look at the Baltic states, Latvia would be a prime candidate because it has a large Russian population. So that seems to be his modus operandi.
Reminiscent of Hitler's, wasn't it? About Sudetenland.
Well, Hitler's was even worse. But it's the same grab. Land grab kind of operation.
A pretext for a land grab.
A pretext. Yeah, you need some excuse, and that's been.
It's popular with the story totalitarians.
Now they've changed the story recently to say all these people are fascists and Nazis, and so it's a broader picture now, and so we're fighting Nazism and fascism. The Russians are saying
they've been doing that for some time. Steve, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to just ask you to draw on your expertise in the defense industrial base of this country to talk about the implications of what we have transferred to the Ukrainians so far, which we may find ourselves in need of if the balloon goes up with China, which I know you've been warning about for some time, too. We'll talk with Steve Brian, former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, now Senior Fellow with the Center for Security Policy, about all of that and more on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. We're back. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Stephen Bryan, senior fellow with our Center for Security Policy, a man with long experience in the national security battle space, in the Defense Department for a time on Capitol Hill as well, and not least as a senior executive in the defense industrial sector. Steve, let me ask you to talk a little bit about your experiences to flesh out where you think we are at the moment in terms of sort of at the macro level, the quality, the robustness, well, even the adequacy of our defense industrial base, and most especially and specifically the problem that we seem to now be having replenishing the stocks of Javelins and Stingers and the like that we have transferred in large quantity to Ukraine, right, which may be really needed in the event we find ourselves confronting military action by China.
Well, for example, we're not delivering them to Taiwan because we don't have any. It's as simple as that. We have a peacetime defense industrial base. Not a war, and it's not on a war footing. It's not being mobilized in any particular way. The Pentagon has been very slow about giving contracts to Lockheed and Raytheon and other companies. They're giving them, but very slowly. There's a long lead time to produce these weapons. They're fairly sophisticated. It takes a minimum of 2 years, maybe longer, in some cases 4 or 5 years. The supply chain is a mess because a lot of the suppliers of components, let's say for the Stinger, which is a system that was designed in 1981, don't exist anymore. So they have to redesign parts of it. So we're talking about some real problems, the real problems in terms of being able to keep up supplies, both for Ukraine. And then the mess is really going to be in the Pacific area, because if we are weak there, and it's not just Taiwan, it's also our own people, our own Air Force, our own Marines, our Navy, who don't have the equipment they need. HIMARS, which is very famous now in Ukraine because it's been very effective, is in very short supply, very short supply. And they have not been able to deliver them to Taiwan. They're not even delivering them to the U.S. Marines on Okinawa. So it's that kind of mess. It's a long-range precision missile system, a rocket system, that multiple fire rocket system.
And it's proven very effective in Ukraine, and they're asking for more of them, and we don't have them for our own forces. And Steve, I just wonder, as a serious student of these things and strategist, what do you think is the likelihood that Putin and Xi cooked up this invasion of Ukraine in anticipation that a second front would be particularly helpful if they did want to go for it in the Pacific?
Well, you know, analysts have said for years that that's the big risk is a two-front war. And the Pentagon has said, for at least in recent years, can't fight a two-front war. They don't have the capability. And just in ammunition alone, now we know that. It's an accurate projection.
Talk a little bit about ammunition, because you've written a piece recently about that being in such short supply that it's a good investment, but also a critical national security.
Well, I mean, we're out of bullets. I mean, this is a famous Russian joke about being out of bullets, but we're out of bullets. The 155 millimeter howitzer rounds, which are very, very important to Ukraine, key part of the artillery that they have facing Russian artillery, we're out of them. We don't have any. We just cut a deal on paper, at least, with the Koreans, South Korea, for 100,000 rounds. But it's controversial in South Korea, so whether it actually goes through or not is still very much in doubt. Let's put it that way.
And how soon we'll get them is also...
Well, it's a couple years away. Yeah, it's a couple years away.
And in the meantime, there is this yawning vulnerability. I mentioned that you've written a book published by our Center for Security Policy Press, I'm pleased to say, called Stopping a Taiwan Invasion.
Right.
And among other things, you're talking about kitting up the Taiwanese in a very significant way. For the reasons you've mentioned, I presume, but also for policy reasons? Is the Biden administration slow rolling this?
Well, I kind of suspect that's the case. I can't prove it. I mean, because the evidence is the evidence. Stuff's not getting there. But they claim it's supply problems, and we have this difficulty. But let's take the F-16V, which is the new F-16 supposed to go to Taiwan. Now that's delayed. It has nothing to do with the Ukraine war, whatever. And yet it's delayed. Why is it delayed? There's no excuse for that, other than maybe they told Lockheed to slow it down. I think there's an under-the-table deal with the Chinese. I mean, honestly. And that deal says...
Joe Biden's been doing under-the-table deals with the Chinese for some time.
Well, did it in energy. I guess you may have seen this, the battery technology that he just gave $200 million to a Chinese company to make batteries. I mean, completely nuts.
It's obscene. Well, yeah. It's at the very time that we're now hearing more and more about these supply chain dependencies on China.
And that makes it
a national security problem, especially if you're reducing your energy security posture to make it now more dependent upon.
Well, we're all going to use solar energy to propel our cars down the road.
Not clear we'll do that anytime soon, that's for sure.
Have a big...
Steve, just very quickly, and we've got a minute left. As things stand now, are you of the view that basically the position we're in, the position our Taiwanese allies are in, and for that matter, others, our friends in the region, that it's kind of an open invitation to the Chinese to do what Xi says he's going to do, which is to go for it?
It's very dangerous. I mean, there's no doubt that this is very dangerous. And I think the Biden administration has made a terrible error in not really bolstering up Taiwan and bolstering up our own defenses in the region in a serious way. They're doing quite the opposite, and it's very disturbing.
It is. It's disturbing. It's dangerous, as you say, and it could prove very deadly. Indeed.
Absolutely.
Here's the kicker. It doesn't need to be this way. We may still have the option we certainly have had for the past 2 years to deter China, and we will rue the day if we fail to have done so.
I agree.
Steve Brannan, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again soon if you would. In the meantime, keep up the great work.
Thanks, Frank. Take care of yourself.
Security policy. Thanks to all of you for listening to this edition of Securing America. Come back tomorrow for more. Until then, go forth and multiply.